You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
I spoke to Human Rights Watch reporter for Indonesia, Andrea Sasano, on the rise of political Islam. We also speak on the discrimination between minority religions, LGBTQ plus community, the ethnic Chinese, and the 2019 elections, which is one of the largest democratic processes. Could you speak on how religion and politics are so intrinsically linked?
After the fall of President Suharto, there are, of course, open spaces and multiple parties in Indonesia use those open spaces to advocate their respective discourses, including political Islam. And of course, they would like to implement the so-called Islamic Sharia in Indonesia. They argue that Islam is the majority religion in Indonesia. Thus, they want Muslim women to wear hijab. Thus, they want Muslim women not to travel without their husband or fathers or son, especially in the evening. They want Muslim women to cover up, not to wear pants, not to wear a short sleeve shirt, and many others made in the name of Islamic Sharia. Unfortunately, this Islamic Sharia produced more than 600 regulations now in Indonesia, including those that discriminate non-Islam minorities, including Christian, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, including non-Sunni Islam. Islam, of course, is a big religion. It has many minorities, including Shia, including Ahmadiyya, Druze, Ismailiyya, Mila Abraham, and I can name hundreds of them, including even in some places, non-Shafi'i minorities. Indonesian Muslims are mostly Sunni, and Sunni is divided into more or less four school of thought. Shafi'ism is one of them, and Shafi'i is the Sunni that most Indonesian Muslims adhere to. So now they are even discriminating against non-Shafi'i Sunni Muslim. That is really bad, because I believe that Islam is a religion with so much literature, so much interpretation, so rich differences, multiple interpretation of Islam. But with the fall of Suharto, and we are seeing the rise of more and more Islamist government, local and national government, they are starting to discriminate non-Muslim, non-Sunni minorities. They are also discriminating women. They are also discriminating, lately, LGBT individual.
How has LGBT rights been in Indonesia recently?
It was pretty good, because again, pre-Suharto Indonesia, we are seeing there is no discrimination against LGBT. Of course, there are always misunderstanding against gay or lesbian, or social pressure against transgender. But with the arrival of this political Islam, we are now having more than 20 anti-LGBT discriminatory regulation. In Aceh, for instance, homosexuality is a crime. So if you are caught having gay sex, for instance, you will be punished, in some cases, caning in public. Other areas, public spaces for trans LGBT individual are restricted. That create quite a problem, because many gay men, many lesbian women, or transgender is the biggest victim of them all, are being criminalized. They are losing their job, they are losing their hotspot. One problem that arose because of this discrimination is the HIV counseling and medication for male who have sex with male is decreasing in Indonesia. And of course, it is a disservice to these community members. So it is worrying. It is a worrying trend in Indonesia.
Ethnic Chinese have also been subject to discrimination as well. Could you speak a little bit on that?
Ethnic Chinese is the most consistent scapegoat in the history of not only Indonesia, but also the Dutch Indies.
Why? Why is that?
Because the Dutch Indies, the Dutch government at the time, used ethnic Chinese as a middleman to kind of buffer between ruling Dutch people, European, and the so-called indigenous people throughout the Dutch Indies archipelago, now becoming Indonesia. That was the beginning. Rather than dealing directly with indigenous people in Indonesia, the Dutch used ethnic Chinese. Things became worse after the 1740 Chinese massacre in the then Batavia. Dozens of thousands of ethnic Chinese were killed. And the pattern keep on repeating until now, despite the fact that ethnic Chinese had been living for centuries in Indonesia, and many of them do not speak Mandarin. Their physical appearances are also very similar, and many of them are poor, of course. Many of them are middle-class members of their respective societies. It happened again in the 1940s. It happened in the 1960s, after the 1965 killing. Mm. It happened at the height of the Asian economic crisis in 1998. And now it is now being tried to be revived again during the presidential election, and also with the rise of Islamism in Indonesia.
Mm. Because the 2019 elections in Indonesia were one of the largest democratic elections. How is that process, watching all these voters come in? How was that electoral process?
It was a fair and relatively clean election. President Jokowi won his re-election by siding with a hardline cleric, actually, Ma'ruf Amin. But at the same time, religion was being used widely. People being told, Muslim voters especially, being told that if you don't vote Jokowi opponent, General Prabowo, you might go to hell, basically. No? Or in some cases, other Muslim will not cleanse your body for burial. It was very ugly. President Jokowi basically was elected based on three major constituencies. One is ethnic Javanese, the largest ethnic group in Indonesia, 42%. And the second is Nahdlatul Ulama Muslim. Nahdlatul Ulama is also predominantly ethnic Javanese Muslim group, the largest Muslim group in Indonesia. And the third are Christian or Hindus in Bali. Christian are the largest religious minority in Indonesia. I think they voted Jokowi out of fear, because they fear the Islamists that align themselves with General Prabowo.
That was part two of the interview with Andreas. The first part is on BFM Bcasts, on his new book, Race, Islam and Power, and we also speak on what's next for West Papua.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.